netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today we're going to do something a little special. If you're a regular listener of the FX Podcast, you've probably heard our interviews with Paul Franklin from Double Negative, visual effects supervisor from Double Negative, talking about a latest film. Mike decided he wanted to talk to Paul about some of the tools that they've kind of touched on in some of these podcasts, but talk more specifically in depth about not a specific film, but the tools that Double Negative has developed in-house to do the work. So you'll want to check that out. Before we get to that, I also want to mention that in this written story that accompanies this article, and they touch on it briefly in the podcast, they discussed the new appointment of, recently we covered the closing of Asylum VFX, and CEO Nathan McGinnis is now heading up the Double Negative Singapore office as creative director. So there's a little more detail in the written story about that, and also they'll talk about it in the podcast briefly, but if you want more, there's check out fxguide.com and look for the written story about this podcast. Before we get into the actual interview, I just wanted to mention real quickly that there's a new term, January term, at fxphd.com, our sister site. We're really focused this term on workflow, motion graphics, roto fixes. I think it's interesting, you'll see there's three different new stereo courses. If you look at the FX PhD site, there'll be an orientation video soon, if it's not there already. And also, that'll be a shortened version of that will be in the next FX Guide TV coming up soon. So if you want to check out what's going on, head on over to fxphd.com. People just love what we're doing there, and it's getting great reviews. And people using FX PhD for training, as initial training on a piece of software or techniques, but also just to change the game, up their skills, add new skills. For example, an artist learning about 3D tracking, even though that may not be their principal job, but to understand better what the problems are. Or the example I use a lot is Red Camera, for example, the workflows that have to deal with the Red Camera, understanding that even though you may not ever shoot with the Red Camera, but invariably you'll end up posting it. So if you're in that side of the business, it's a good idea to just kind of check out and learn before you get faced with the problems. And that's kind of one of the things we specialize on over at FX PhD. So take a chance to check that out. Anyway, let's jump in now to Mike Seymour speaking with Paul Franklin of Double Negative.
So Paul, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in the current run-up to the awards series or sequence, I think in England you'd call it the season, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah.
You guys have quite a few films that are in contention, certainly on the shortlist for the Academy. I believe five, is that right?
I think there's actually six of the films out of the 15 Double Negative contributed to in one way or another.
So there's a lot that we could discuss today, and I wish we had like hours to chat but I think what we should do is maybe just discuss, if we could, some of the tools that DNEG uses to pull these things off. And obviously you've got a really great team of people there, and I take nothing away from the individuals. In fact, I used to laugh when I was a compositor when people used to walk in and see a shot I'd done and say, wow, aren't these boxes great?
But, yes, of course.
But if we acknowledge for a second that all of the tools that you're using are written by, you know, very valid members of the DNEG team, then I think it's worthwhile to sort of focus some attention on some of the tools, because DNEG has a sort of a proprietary approach to a lot of software, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of that's grown out of necessity. You know, we started out very much with an off-the-shelf, commercially available pipeline, you know, Maya, Shake, RenderMan, and various other tools to stitch those things together. But over the years, you know, as the demands from the filmmakers get greater and greater, you know, the response to that has been to write a lot of our own solutions to get the pictures that they want to see in their films.
Well, we'll get into those tools in one second, but one of the reasons that I thought it was valid to talk to you about this is that you have such a strong personal background coming up from computer graphics, in fact, from games, which may surprise some people. What was the path that got you to DNEG in terms of your technical skill base?
Well, my background originally is in fine art. You know, I have a degree in sculpture. I went to art school back in the 1980s. And I guess, fact, you know, I was... Sorry, yes, you were saying?
You read fine arts at Oxford, didn't you?
Yes, that's right. At the rather elaborately named Ruskin School of Drawing and Fine Art, which is the name of the art department at Oxford University. And... yeah, I was. I studied art there in the 1980s, and I was very interested in using technology to help make my art. And I was particularly fascinated by the idea of using computer graphics to visualize my sculpture. And in fact, to begin with, I actually made artwork from computers. I used to buy old secondhand computers, which I think had been used in some local scientific research center, and they used to turn up in the army surplus stores in the town in Oxford.
Now, Paul, you and I are almost exactly the same age, and I did fine arts and pure maths at university doing computer mm-hmm. science. So I can know that when you were doing this, this is a very different age of computers. I mean, I was learning on a PDP-11. Yeah. This
yes.
is not the age of laptops and personal computers. When you were going through at fine art level, saying that you're using computers for art, it must have been quite an avant-garde part of the fine arts program.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, there were no digital resources at all within the art department. The most advanced piece of kit they had was a giant piece of hardware called a photomechanical transfer machine, which I think it had an LED counter on it for timing the exposures. And that was as far as it went in terms of digital technology in the art department. But what we did have is we had access to some of the other university departments. And I used to go down to the computer teaching department of the engineering school and get access to their PCs. They had a bunch of very early PCs with, I think, VGA displays on them. And I used to use paintbrush to make images, and then to record them, I would take long exposures of the screens of the cathode ray tubes and put them onto transparencies, and then reproject these transparencies onto my installation sculpture that I was making, or sometimes print them off as big cibachromes, which is a very expensive way of making a hard copy of the things. But it was they look fantastic, actually. As we said, I still have some of them.
And before you went to MPC, you worked in video games, didn't you?
Yes, I worked for a British games company called Psygnosis, which was a large independent British publisher, video games publisher, up in the northwest in Liverpool, which is the part of the country that I come from. I come from Cheshire, and it's a neighbouring county. And I worked at Psygnosis for a couple of years as a graphics games artist, initially doing bitmap graphics with the Commodore Amiga, and that was really my first experience of 3D computer graphics. I was using a thing called Sculpt Animate 4D on the Amiga, which was actually a real workhorse in the games industry for doing 3D graphics. And I was lucky that ended up at this company, because they were one of the very first games companies to start using really serious 3D hardware. And they bought a bunch of SGI Indigo R3000 workstations and ran Softimage. I think Softimage 1.0 or something like that was running on the machines.
I do remember Softimage at that point had the remarkable ability to take something that looked like a solid and bend it. And just
yes.
bending it was considered to be the most remarkable thing in computer graphics.
Yes, all the deformers and the lattice deformers
yeah.
were really, you know, really hot stuff at the time, completely new. So it was all very, very exciting. And that brought us to the attention of Sony, and we were absorbed by Sony, and the Psygnosis transformed into Sony Computer Entertainment and became one of the early developers for the PlayStation.
And then at some point you just basically got involved in doing both independent films and, of course, moved over to MPC, and from MPC to DNEG in, what, 1998, is that right?
Yes, it was. Well, it was something I'd always been involved in filmmaking right back to university, because I was very much involved in student drama, which I sort of did as a parallel self-directed course in sort of commercially applied art whilst I was a student. And all the guys I was working with in the drama group, it turned out we were all interested in making films. And we continued making, you know, low-budget films, first shooting them with camcorders and then graduating to 16mm and finally 35mm. And it was whilst I was at Psygnosis I was using the computers in downtime to generate graphics for the films, and that got me noticed by MPC. They hired me in 94. I worked there for about four and a half years, and then there was a bunch of us from MPC. We struck out on our own, and we set up Double Negative in 1998.
Now, when you set up Double Negative, you were actually pretty much the sort of manager or supervisor, I guess, of the 3D department. That was your sort of stake in the sand at the newly formed DNEG. Was that correct?
Yes, that's right. My job was to set up the 3D department and get it going to to deliver all the 3D graphics for the film Pitch Black, which is our first project at Double Negative.
So how'd that work out for you, Paul?
Well, I have to say, I often look back at it and I say, if I'd known how hard it was going to be to do, I probably wouldn't have done it. But it's like all things, really. You don't really know until you get involved in it. And it turned out pretty well. You know, Pitch Black was a film that we didn't expect very much from, to be perfectly honest. It happened to be the most convenient project to get the facility up and running. And it turned out to be a little bit of a low budget indie gem, and still gets shown on TV over here. So people still seem to like it.
So, as I say, taking nothing away from the fabulous team of artists, some of whom I've accidentally insulted over my comments on Scott Pilgrim on this very network. But I turned up at DNEG before Christmas just to visit a friend, and somebody introduced me as, this is the guy that hated Scott Pilgrim. I was like, I didn't hate your work, I just didn't like them. I thought Inception was a masterpiece. But anyway, what I want to do is, instead of just discussing, going through obviously trying to name everyone in every department, I would actually like to just swing our attention to the tools that your collective team has produced over time. And I think one of the things that's probably to us in the industry most apparent is that pretty early on, DNEG seemed to nail a lot of very key rigid body solutions that allowed you to tackle a bunch of problems that led to maybe a bit of a reputation as being the go-to guys for destroying things and cities and stuff. Do you think that's a fair historical reflection?
Well, I think, you know, we've always had very smart people in our R&D team. And the R&D team there's a separate R&D team which, you know, comes up with really great tools. And then there's also a bunch of people within the rest of the 3D and 2D departments who are also involved in R&D projects. And it kind of, so there's sort of that expertise and skill diffuses out into the larger team. And one of the things that they came up with quite a while ago was they implemented various rigid body dynamic solvers and put them into a framework which allowed us to manipulate lots and lots of objects in a pretty efficient and creatively directed way. And so you can see evidence of that in things like the work that we did on Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix and the destruction of the Hall of Prophecy, where there's the giant warehouse made out of glass shelves comes collapsing down. And that's all done with our in-house dynamics tool, which is called Dynamite, which is a plugin for Maya. And I think that gave us a bit of an advantage over some of the other people we were competing against at the time to be able to do that sort of thing.
Well, let's run through some of the more infamous or famous in-house tools that you've got. You mentioned Dynamite. That's, there's also Squirt. Now, that's your fluid dynamics solver?
Yes. I mean, Squirt is a much more sophisticated piece of software. It's a pretty comprehensive, state-of-the-art fluid solver that allows us to do a whole range of different things. And you can see Squirt at work in Inception, in the big splashes when the buildings collapse into the sea. We use Squirt an awful lot in the work that we did on 2012 the other year, in the destruction of the Yellowstone caldera, when the super volcano blows up, all those giant pyroclastic clouds billowing through the park. That's all Squirt. And so it's a very, very important tool to us.
So Dynamite and Squirt work in harmony, presumably. And Dynamite's been extended, hasn't it? Because, I mean, you mentioned 2012. You did stuff there with glue strengths and, you know, basically aggregates for more complicated destruction sequences.
Yeah, Dynamite can handle all that kind of stuff. We also use Dynamite in tandem with Houdini as well. And so we have a lot of our own, you know, kind of plugins and setups and scripts all built up inside Houdini. So there's a very strong Houdini team at Double Negative as well. So all these things, the proprietary solutions extend and enhance a lot of the off-the-shelf solutions, but then in some cases they end up standing alone in their own right, in the case of something like Squirt.
And then there are things like DN Shatter, which I believe was an update on DN Crack, or are they running in tandem?
Well, Shatter was something that was developed to actually as a response to trying to create the glass shattering patterns that we needed to create for that destruction sequence in the Hall of Prophecy, where we wanted to shatter the shelves. And it was actually, if you watch that sequence carefully, you see very little evidence of the glass actually breaking. The big shelf units all kind of decompose into their individual pieces, you know, the actual flat shelves and all the supports and everything. But there's only a couple of shots where you see things actually beginning to shatter properly. And so when we came onto the Dark Knight and we had this sequence where the helicopter, which is pursuing the Joker's truck through the streets of Gotham City, ends up crashing into a skyscraper and smashing out all of the windows in a big glass-sided skyscraper, we wanted to have much more convincing glass shattering patterns, and so DN Shatter was developed as a response to that, and then it works on top of Dynamite.
Right, and this is all feeding into DMB, which is your renderer.
DNB is our volumetric renderer, and that was actually originally developed for use on Batman Begins to create all the giant steam plumes, you know, from Ra's al Ghul's microwave emitter that causes all the water in the Gotham water pipelines to boil. And the special effects guys, Chris Corbould's team on the set, had built these incredible steam geysers which shot great screaming jets of steam about 60 feet into the air, which are just extraordinary to behold. And we realized we were going to have to make digital versions of these things. So something that the guys had been playing around with in the R&D department, we pushed very, very hard, and they managed to get that thing out in time to be able to render all the steam plumes for Batman Begins. And since then, DNB has been through several generations. And DNB doesn't mean anything particularly exotic. It just stands for double negative renderer B. There was a DNA at one time,
which would have been a cooler name, but
DNA was a particle renderer that was used in the little scene film Below, which is a sort of supernatural ghost story on a set on a submarine, and we used that to create all the sort of underwater plankton and stuff that swirled around the submarine. It's pretty effective, and the shots still look pretty good even now, I think. So then that was where we kind of really kicked off the really hardcore renderer development at Double Negative, is with that package DNA.
There's got to be a lot of destruction sequences that you've done. Obviously, take Inception, for example, with the glacial type of drop into the sea of his own subconscious. Mm. But I mean, if we just go through a destruction sequence in its sort of, I don't know, textbook, if I was to look it up under some kind of textbook thing, it would say that you'd basically take an object, a piece of geometry, you'd break it somehow, either procedurally or pre-break it, and then you'd basically end up with more geometry, of course, and then at some point you'd want to somehow solve some collision detection on that or have some kind of physics stuff on it, and then you'd swap out the RBS geo or the point cloud or whatever for real geometry, render the darn stuff by tweaking it and putting it through some kind of renderer. But that kind of skips over the really big problems of doing these kind of sequences, which I would guess are two things. Firstly, the sheer volume of what we're talking about, because when you just sort of break it down like that, it sounds pretty easy. And if you have a diagram with a ball shattering on a desk, it all seems pretty easy. But you don't shatter balls on desks, you shatter cities. And the second thing is, once you start shattering a city, the collision detection problem, the physics solve, if you like, of that much geo is mind-numbingly complicated. I mean, we're really talking like seriously incredibly complicated sims. How big is your R&D team, and has it been difficult to evolve to these big scale projects?
Well, for a start, the R&D team, I think, currently stands at about, I think there's about 50 or 60 people in the R&D team now at Double Negative. And then there's probably another 30 or 40 people throughout the rest of the project teams, which are contributing to R&D projects in one way or another. But in terms of the complexity of these things, I guess it's an incremental thing. You know, you start off by breaking one thing, and then the next project you ramp it up a little bit further, and you break a few more things, and you break a few more things, and you can look at various projects along the way that we've done that have that have been milestones for us. And I think a good example of a milestone that really marked a difference in level of complexity of what we could do was the film World Trade Center, where we didn't have to collapse. You know, we didn't see the buildings collapse in front of the camera. But what we did have is we had the aftermath of that, and we had the pile at Ground Zero, you know, the wreckage of the Twin Towers. And everybody knows what that looks like. It's such a well-known image on in photographs and on the television that you couldn't really get away with something that had anything less than the complexity of the real thing. So we worked very hard to work out how to use dynamite to actually procedurally model the debris on the pile. So we were actually using dynamics to build up the pile of debris that sits there on ground zero. And that was, I think, the first time we'd really pushed that sort of thing really, really hard. The other thing that we did in that show was we really pushed the fluid dynamics to create, the great big smoke plumes coming off the buildings, which again, everybody knows exactly what they look like. And I think anything that looks anything less than completely convincing there and totally real, would, at the very worst, it could be perceived as an insult to the whole situation, that it just sort of turns it into a visual effects spectacle rather than presenting some sort of objective reality, which is what that film was attempting to be. And that was something where the guys realized they were going to have to commit to simulation times that ran for sims that ran for days and weeks, in fact, in some cases, to actually get those smoke plumes out. And I remember a new member of the team joined us from another large facility, and they'd also been doing a lot of fluids work. And they said, "So, I heard somewhere that you guys let your sims run overnight." And I said, "Well, it's more than just overnight. We let them run for a fortnight." So that was kind of a key moment, I think. And you can look at other shows along the way that do that. 2012 was obviously a big moment. Prince of Persia this last year has a huge amount of simulation and dynamics work in it, which really pushed our ability to do destruction and breaking things into aggregates and smashing them apart. And then that in turn fed into the work on Inception.
I've got to say, I think that Prince of Persia somewhat is overlooked because it's so hard these days, as it always is, I think, to separate visual effects from, the gravitas of the story or the, importance, whatever. And obviously, Prince of Persia is based on a game, and I take nothing away from it, but it doesn't have the same kind of, dramatic beats that an Inception does. But I really thought that the particle work and the stuff that you're talking about in that was really good. And it does provide an enormous amount of production value, doesn't it? I mean, it really can elevate a scene if you can really get your fluid sims, whether it be in water or for that matter, smoke and particles, to work well. It's a tremendous device for giving visual complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting about that film is that in something like the Dagger Time effect, we're using the visual effects to create a subjective, abstract feel rather than something which is, trying to make a photorealistic representation of something that we may have experienced in the real world. And so in that respect, it's similar to the work that I was doing with tools like Squirt on, or rather my team was doing on with tools like Squirt on Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince a year or so ago, where we had to create all of the stuff with the Poncive and things like that. And that kind of work is very much related to the Dagger Time effect on Prince of Persia. And then, yes, we have the more realistic destruction in the sort of sequence in the giant crystal cave at the end of the film underneath the city of Alamut.
Yeah, that was just extraordinary. Can I just get back to the destruction stuff, though, for a second? Because there's one other thing. I mean, a lot of people, you talk about those sims running for very long periods of time. Of course, that sim, when it's over, doesn't actually give you a rendered final frame that you put out to a film recorder.
Not at all.
This is just a stage in the sequence. But at the heart of the physics stuff is the physics engines. And at the moment, there seems to be sort of a couple of obvious choices, maybe three or four obvious choices. But obviously, there's physics stuff that NVIDIA picked up from Novacad X. There's the FISBAM stuff that is out of California that obviously ILM's worked closely with. There's Bullet, which is open source, which has been picked up by quite a lot of people.
Yes.
Is there a physics engine at your heart that you can describe to us or mention?
Well, I believe Dynamite initially was using the ODE physics engine, the Open Dynamics Engine.
Right.
And I think we are looking at Bullet as well at the moment. There's a bunch of other stuff which goes on as well, and the guys are obviously, like I say, they're working very, very hard with Houdini as well. And it's you get to a point where sometimes where the setups that you actually can build within an off-the-shelf piece of software constitute a proprietary pipeline in their own right, I think.
Yeah.
So there's no one thing I think that you can actually point to. There's a whole collection of things actually going into this stuff now.
And do you guys basically pre-shatter? Do you use sort of procedural Voronoi diagram type stuff? Are you using level set methods? I mean, how are you doing this shattering, creaking?
We are pre-shattering a lot of stuff. And so things like the destruction in of the buildings in Inception is pre-shattered. And that's, again, as I say, that was done inside Houdini. And then in something like the sequence in the destruction of the Paris Cafe, you know, where it all blows apart into this sort of crazy slow-motion underwater world as Ariadne loses control of the dream, that's using both Houdini stuff and also dynamite and DN Shatter, which is our own proprietary sort of pre-shattering solution.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because while we've been talking about destruction stuff, you mentioned the Paris sequence. I think the other thing that we haven't yet to touch on is how good the lighting R&D stuff has been at DNEG in terms of nailing lighting. The Paris, I'm guessing in Inception, was probably the most challenging lighting solution. Would that be right?
Yes, it was. I mean, the one thing that's a good advantage, and, you know, gives us a great advantage in doing something like Paris, is that you can record very, very precise objective reference. You know, you've got Paris there on the location, and you can photograph it under the appropriate lighting conditions. And, you know, we were there for weeks photographing the buildings under all sorts of different lighting conditions to make sure that we got that absolutely nailed. And then the guys in the R&D team and also the shader development team, they were rolling out a comprehensive revision of all of our shading tools, which then fed into the sort of believability and realism of what you actually see there.
When you and I first talked about the first Batman film, we talked about HDRI and BRDFs and anisotropic spec functions and stuff, which was all great. If we run the clock forward till now, one of the films that you're in contention for is Iron Man 2, which obviously is an ILM as well. Film, and ILM has done a lot of work in their lighting systems, and especially in Iron Man. And I believe in a lineage of, or a very sort of strong heritage of films, because they've had a lot of rigid, hard surface, a lot of car JUCOs type films from Transformers and Terminator, and going right back to even Pearl Harbor when they first started doing stuff. Now, at the moment, it seems like that development has led them to a very realistic kind of lighting model where, in all essential purposes, there's full energy conservation. The way it's working is really tight. We're also seeing out of Weta stuff with spherical harmonics on Avatar, and which is giving this kind of directional ambient. Where is your lighting pipeline at? How advanced, and is it an area that you've done much work in lately?
Well, we've looked at things like energy conservation, and that was something that I was quite keen to implement to begin with on Inception. In the end, we didn't actually roll that out, and instead we opted to spend our R&D budget into making the tools more interactive and faster to work with, so that the artists could then actually, you know, nail the look directly by tweaking the lighting settings. I mean, I'm a firm believer in using physically correct ways of actually lighting things as much as possible. But at the same time, I also want to make sure that the artists have lots and lots of direct control over what they're actually doing. Because to me, that's actually one of the things that was always appealing in the first place about doing computer graphics, you know, coming back to, you know, me being the head of 3D when Double Negative first started, was that I didn't want to work with computer graphics because of the fact that it could be, you know, a completely accurate simulation of the real world, because that seemed to actually defeat the purpose of doing it. You know, it almost felt like, well, if you wanted to do that, you should just go and think of a way of actually building this thing for real and photographing it, because I think you'll still get a better result if you can afford to build the thing, and if there's a way of doing it, then you can probably get a better result that way. But and I always felt that it's important to basically trust the artist to be able to get it right, to be able to create the look that you want. And I extend that philosophy into things like crowd simulations, you know, where there's, you know, we did some quite complex crowd work on The Dark Knight, but rather than getting overly reliant on artificial intelligence solutions, we spent a lot of time building a system which allowed the artists to basically guide the action of the crowd directly themselves, rather than relying on a simulation engine. And we used the same tools again when we were creating the background pedestrians in the street scenes in Inception as well. So I think that's, I mean, you know, it's an important way to go.
I mean, clearly it worked in Inception, and I think that Paris sequence, I think you told me last time, was like a 1,000-frame long continuous shot rather than the sort of four cuts it ended up in the in the film. And, you know, those things like, well, for example, when you did the asphalt breaking up behind the train that remarkably appears down the middle of LA streets, that stuff is all terrific. But in the case of Iron Man, and you had to produce a suit, the pop-up suit from the bag in the Monaco sequence, when ILM was producing suits, obviously, later in the film. So there was a much more sort of, well, it wasn't any sort of deliberate rivalry, but, I mean, you were in the same film. You had to
sort of match. No, it has to meet, you know, the work on the suitcase suit had to meet the standard that was being set by ILM, you know, and obviously they had set a very, very, you know, they'd raised the bar very, very high on the first film, on the previous film, on Iron Man itself, and also, of course, with all the work on Transformers. So, you know, there's, as I say, it's an incremental approach to improving the way that the lighting system works.
Do you think you would go on to do or you might continue to look at doing sort of energy conservation? I mean, do you think that's a good path to be going down in a broad industry sense?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think there's those sorts of things. It makes perfect sense to have lights that you can actually, you can get them to behave the way that real lights actually behave. I think one of the reasons why, you know, we were kind of looking at it was, it was, you know, it was computationally quite expensive. So, so we decided to steer away from that and go towards something that was a more interactive way of working. But I think they're both perfectly valid ways of working. And, you know, the fact is that whilst you could actually set up a completely photorealistic lighting simulation of, or physically correct simulation of the way the lighting should work in, say, something like Paris folding over or the suitcase suit popping up, the fact still remains that these things are not real and that they couldn't really exist in the real world. That and this is what I'm getting at with the, you know, this is the reason why I like to use computer graphics, is that the suitcase suit is probably impossible to engineer any time in the next, I don't know, 50 years without you know, advances in nanotechnology to actually make these things work. And, you know, the likelihood of Paris ever folding up into a cube is pretty small. So it's difficult to say, well, what would that really look like? And, you know, in the case of Paris, there's a blatant lighting cheat goes on during the shot, which is that if the street really folded over and closed in on itself, it would completely blot out the sun and plunge the whole scene into night. So that would be the physically correct way of conserving energy in there.
Sure. But of course, that's at the heart of modern-day visual effects, isn't it? Because why do you say it would be, obviously, it is impossible. It probably will never be able to solve the suit bag problem because it seems to defy, it seems to be a TARDIS-type operation. Nevertheless, for it to sell to an audience, they have to believe that those materials look real. They have to believe the suit looks like it's metal. I mean, the fact is, if you're wearing a suit of armor, it wouldn't be a particularly good way to get around. But that doesn't matter, right? Because we have to believe that that looks like Car Juco, because I know Car Juco and it looks pretty. So you've got the duality of producing the impossible, but making it look as believable and as familiar as possible.
You rely on a lot of physically accurate simulation techniques to basically get you to first base, to get you to the point where the metal looks like metal and the you know, the lacquer coat and everything looks like it's supposed to be what it's supposed to be. But then, you know, you are relying upon the creative input of the artists to sell it to the audience and to meet audience expectation. And audience expectation and reality, I always maintain, are two different things. You know, for instance, if you want to do a film about people walking on the surface of the moon and they're jumping around and kicking up great big clouds of dust, well, that's audience expectation that they'd be kicking up great big clouds of dust. The reality is you don't get clouds of dust on the moon and it looks completely unnatural, but then everyone says, well, it looks fake. So it's that kind of thing, you know. So if we had, you know, as I say again with Paris, if we had the street folding over and plunging it into night, I think everyone would be saying, "Hey, who turned out the lights? You know, why is the sun gone out?" Rather than, "Oh, look, that's physically correct. That's what would be happening."
Which brings us to the compositing side of things, which obviously not, you know, fundamentally your forte, but obviously you're very familiar with. Which here, Dienig has gone down a path of developing and building on Shake, as opposed to what a lot of people have been doing lately, which is going with Nuke. Can you comment on your compositing pipeline?
Well, the Shake thing was that I think, like a lot of other large Shake pipelines a few years ago, we were suddenly confronted with the prospect that there wasn't going to be any more development on Shake. And then Apple offered the option to purchase the source code so that we could continue our own internal development on the package. And, you know, quite a few major facilities took the plunge and bought the source code and continued to develop Shake internally. And where we took it was that when we were doing The Dark Knight, we suddenly realized, well, we realized very quickly that that Shake as it stood, the 32-bit build of Shake, which was the last version that Apple had released, was not going to be able to handle the high resolutions needed for the IMAX work in that film. You know, Shake becomes increasingly unreliable the further you go past 2K. You know, you can work in 4K at Shake on Shake, but you know, Shake 32-bit, but it's not particularly reliable. And certainly, if we were going to push it to 5.6 and 8K, which is what was needed for The Dark Knight, it was going to be a complete non-starter. So our R&D team rolled out a 64-bit build of Shake, which also substantially improved some aspects of the package as well, speeding them up, and we managed to optimize all of our internal proprietary plugins for Shake as well to work in the new 64-bit build. And that basically meant Shake's lifespan was extended by a few years, which gave us some breathing space to be able to just look at what else was going on in the market and to see, you know, what was going to come up. Because at that stage, it was by no means you know, a given thing, a done deal that that Nuke was going to take over and become the new de facto platform for everybody to actually work with. I think Inception and probably, well, actually probably this last Harry Potter film will probably be our last major all Shake project. And we are, you know, we have purchased a Nuke site license, and we're slowly moving over the whole facility over to Nuke. So I would expect that my next project will be a Nuke-based project and not Shake.
That next project wouldn't be another masked, caped crusader, would it?
Well, it's another film with Christopher Nolan, so I guess I'll probably leave it at that.
So how does this all go with you staffing up? Because you've got an enormous amount of very high-quality people, but with proprietary tools, it's not easy for someone to walk in off the street and just start on a project. So that idea of having a pool of freelancers that rises and falls at the end of each project must be somewhat more difficult.
Well, it's something that we try to avoid where at all possible. You know, we're not keen on the whole hire and fire sort of thing. And basically what it means is if you want to retain your staff, you have to basically commit to, you know, progressive, steady growth. And this has led to, you know, the company is now heading towards 1,000 people worldwide. So it's, you know, and that, you know, obviously brings its own problems with it, which is, you know, the biggest challenge is how do you maintain what it was that made Double Negative an attractive place to work at in the first place when we were, say, 150 people, when you are, you know, getting on for 10 times the size. So it's, that's probably our biggest challenge rather than the whole business of the hire and fire thing. I mean, what you do have is you have instead a, you know, there's a whole generation of visual effects artists now who I think have embraced the whole itinerant lifestyle. I think you read a lot on the internet about people saying, oh, well, you know, there's no stability in this business. You can't keep a job in one place for any time. You have to keep moving on. And I think that is a problem for a lot of people. I don't think it's necessarily a problem for people who come to work at a Double Negative, assuming they want to stay in London, because obviously that's where our main base is. But, you know, I see people who, they say, well, I'm just here for a year and then I'm going on to Australia or I'm going on to the United States after that. So that's kind of the interesting thing, is, you know, how do you maintain continuity in that kind of environment?
Yeah, and I guess from both sides, that's a very friendly position to be in. I mean, when people are moving on because they're on a project for a while and then move on to the next thing, you neither resent them moving on and they don't resent the fact that they've got a short-term contract, because it's, as you say, it's like a particular way of working. But you did mention there the idea of, you know, expansion, and that brings me to Singapore. You've got DNX Singapore, and very excitingly, Nathan's joined you. Can you touch on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know too much about all the dealings that were going on there, because I've been pretty much taking it easy since the end of Inception, and I'm just about to head off to Los Angeles to start prep on my next film. Nathan is joining us over in Los Angeles. Obviously, we partnered with Asylum on Sorcerer's Apprentice. You know, we shared that show last year, and Asylum did some absolutely stunning work, I thought, on the film. And it's going to be a great thing, I think, for our team out in Singapore, bringing in somebody with Nathan's creative ability and breadth of experience into that environment, which is a very, you know, there's a very new team out there, and they're very keen to prove themselves and do big things.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to Nathan separately, but about the Singapore operation itself, is that, walk me through how that's going to work. Is Singapore a roto sort of station for outsourcing to, or is it an integrated part, or is it going to tackle its own productions and stay separate from London? How's it going to work inside the framework?
Well, it's all of those, really. It's initially we set it up using it as an outsourcing department for roto and match moving and things like that. But the intention has always been that it will eventually be a standalone facility capable of tackling its own major jobs. And bringing in Nathan is a whole part of the plan to actually establish it with its own creative identity and give it its own skills base to be able to tackle the kind of shows that we're doing over in London. In terms of the pipeline and the tool set, it's on the same system as DNEG over in London. So they've got all of our tools, and their system is set up in a sort of a mirror of the way that we run things over in London. But the outsourcing thing was only ever really seen as a way of getting the thing on its feet, getting it going. There's always been a much more long-term plan there.
Can you comment on why Singapore? I mean, obviously, it's not an odd decision. I mean, ILM's done the same thing, but there seems to be a couple of regional areas on the opposite time zone that have, India, obviously, with Rhythm and Hughes and others. Why did you guys go with Singapore?
Singapore is one of those places that, Singapore's always had strong contacts with the UK. There's, a good understanding of British culture over in Singapore. And
certainly a strong following of Manchester United.
Exactly, yes. And, English is one of the official languages over there. They have a very technically literate workforce. The government there is very proactive in terms of developing Singapore as a big digital media hub for that whole part of the world. And they also make it extremely attractive for companies like Double Negative to get into business over there.
So I guess the question I should ask you is, do you see an end to this expansion? I mean, because you are now one of the largest facilities in the world. There's a handful of facilities that can tackle films that you guys can do. Have you feeling like you're reaching a kind of point where it's going to come to rest, or do you see this expanding further? What's the state of the industry?
Well, I guess the thing is that every few years we've always said, oh, that's we never expect to get this big. This is probably as far as it goes, and then it keeps going. I think the appetite for visual effects in filmmaking is it seems almost limitless. I think the only thing that can limit it would be the total expansion of the film market and entertainment market as a whole, rather than just a specific kind of film, because it's difficult now to think of a film that where you can't use visual effects. I mean, obviously there are films that don't use visual effects, but that's not to say that they couldn't if the directors were thinking about things in a different sort of way. And I think we're seeing more and more directors. I guess Chris Nolan is a great example of somebody who was not somebody who'd ever used visual effects before Dark Knight. Sorry, Batman Begins. And now visual effects is very much an integral part of his filmmaking process. So in terms of where does that mean, companies like Double Negative can actually go in terms of expansion? Well, you can actually look at China, and you can see there are some very large digital content providers over there, which they make a company like Double Negative look quite small. So I think there is potential for even more growth there. But I think what will limit it, or at least change the way that these things go, is just the changing nature of the market itself and the kind of films that we're working on and the kind of role that we take on those films. At the moment, Double Negative is very firmly a post-production service provider. We make visual effects for other people's films, but I think there's plenty of examples, some quite good ones recently, of visual effects companies like Double Negative getting involved in actual production of filmmaking. At the moment, we have no plans to do anything like that, but it's certainly something which you could see in the future.
And in the skill set, we've deliberately not discussed any DN3D or DN stereo plugin, because you guys haven't sort of cornered or put a very strong stake down for any kind of stereo or dimensionalization or anything else like that. Is that deliberate or is it just the projects that have come along? I mean, would you put your hand up for an Avatar 2 or 3 or...?
It's really just the projects that have come along at the moment. I mean, there are several shows at the moment in-house which will have very substantial stereo content. And the guys at DNEG and the R&D team and the tech team have been working extremely hard to build an end-to-end stereo pipeline. So it's certainly not for lack of effort. It's just that the films that we're working on at the moment with the major stereo content don't come out until 2012. So I think.
So you actually do have stereo content films in the pipeline?
Yes. Yeah. There's you know there's a number of films which are need stereo work on them.
Because interestingly, some of the directors that you're obviously personally very well connected with, like Chris Nolan, just have sort of publicly pointed out that they didn't feel they needed 3D to be immersive, and I tend to agree with them. But obviously, there must be a lot of studio pressure to look at 3D.
Yeah, I think there is. You know, there was a fair amount of interest from the studio in obviously making a stereo version of Inception. Chris, I think, rightly chose not to do a stereo version of it because there just wasn't enough time to do it justice. And then subsequently, he doesn't feel that it's important for The Dark Knight Rises. And you know, I tend to agree with him because. You know, what we did with Dark Knight, I thought was pretty immersive in the IMAX version of the film.
I was going to say, yeah, the IMAX aspect of it, I must admit, excited me more than the prospect of seeing it stereoscopically.
Yes, absolutely.
Not that I didn't enjoy other stereoscopic films, but it certainly is a hot area.
I think that's not to say that Chris won't make a fantastic stereo film in the future. It's just something that he's not particularly focused on at the moment. However, we're working with other filmmakers who are very committed to stereo filmmaking, and it's you know it's all part of their plan. So those films, they will be coming out sooner or later.
And if we look at the films that you're in contention, the things like Sorcerers and Scott Pilgrim and Prince of Persia, Inception, Iron Man, there aren't, I mean, we discussed a lot today rigid body stuff, but is there any sort of a desire to get into character animation work? Because none of those films that I've mentioned were particularly heavy in what you might call digital characters or even... Is that something you'd like to see DNEG move into?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we're doing this right now on John Carter of Mars, which we're working with Disney Pixar on that film. And so there is a very substantial creature animation team working away very, very hard on that show right now with Andrew Stanton to realize all the digital characters in that film. So, you know, we did Hellboy 2 a couple of years ago, and that had a substantial creature component to it. And then, of course, before John Carter, we will have Paul, the film, the new Simon Pegg, Nick Frost film. There we go, getting the names the right way around, which Greg Mottola has directed, which features a little Area 51 alien that will be... as the star of the film, which is the product of our creature animation department.
Well, certainly films like John Carter are something that we're incredibly keen to see what you guys do with, because this is probably one of the hottest properties in the industry at the moment. So, look, thank you so much, Paul, for taking time to talk to us, because we really do appreciate
it.
Good luck moving into your awards season. I'm sure that DNEG will be rightly recognised. And we always enjoy talking to you, so thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be part of the show.
Well, I hope you agree that we thought that was a pretty special interview, just a little different than our normal, specifically talking about a film, talking about one of the larger houses in the business and some of the special tools that they use internally and how they evolved and what they call them and how they work and integrate with their facility and their pipeline. I think that's that kind of stuff always interests me, and I hope you enjoyed it. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.